Access number 29065, Mr. Michael White, reel 11. Now, the next thing I wanted to ask you is, when you got shells like that that came in, they were quite interested in the fragments, were they? Now, I found this interesting in your thing. You didn't really enlarge it too much. Can you talk about that? They used to get an intelligence officer come to investigate, to look at the shards, well, the bits of shrapnel.
Yes, as I actually remember that, Connor, when these actual shells used to come over, they used to be like the bang, and then there was all this kind of like ragged pieces of cast iron as such. And when you actually used to go to touch some sort of thing, I mean, they were still hot or quite warm and things like that. And I remember we used to have a officer from the intelligence used to come up, and he used to be kind of inspecting these pieces of ammunition. I suppose he was trying to find out what size shells they were, you know, calibers and things like that, and whose make they were, whether they were perhaps Russian makes or Chinese make, or whether they were kind of like Americans, because in the early part of the war in the 1950s, when the Americans did their big bug outs, I mean, they tried to kind of destroy lots of their places, but lots of stuff was actually captured, and I suppose even the weapons, even like things like the 4.2 mortars. So when they caught the ammunition, so some of this ammunition, what was actually coming over, was perhaps from ex-American.
Now, the next thing I wanted to ask you was about guard duties. I mean, and your duties at night, really. We talked a bit about some of this, but this is when the routine... I mean, you've been there, say, 2 or 3 months by then. You know, we're in January and moving into February. What sort of guard... Did you have guard duties, or were you just in the command post?
Well, it all depended in which position we was at. In our very first position, all the guard duties in those early days were done by the gunners or the drivers. And kind of in the command post, the signallers and the towers used to take it in turns, actually on the wireless sets or on the telephones. And of course, as the actual winter started really getting quite bitter sort of thing, we moved into kind of especially January and February. Those unarmed guards, they used to be kind of either wandering around in our first position, a lot mobile, and of course sometimes they used to pop into the command post or thing, because we used to have this heater in there, and they used to come in, and although they got all this massive clothing on with this big huge parka, and used to have a big hood, and you could actually used to have a wire inside, and you could actually move it to a more or less a slit. And used to come and all their clothing used to be all kind of like all this white kind of frost on them and things like that used to come in for a warm. But being a tire at that time, we were very lucky. We used to kind of take it in turns with the signals on the radios and the telephones.
The other thing I think I've missed out was the rum ration. I would suggest you rum and cigarette ration. So what about rum ration? Did you get it? Did you take it? What do you think of it? How was it issued?
Well, at that time, I mean, I didn't really drink as such, really. I mean, I used to drink beer, but I never particularly actually liked it as such, and used to drink when we're perhaps in Hong Kong and things like that. The main thing, really, because we didn't drink, because as National Servicemen, they didn't really pay us anything, really. We only used to pay us in the early days about 25 shillings and things like that. And but we did have what we call a beer ration, and we used, it was the Japanese Asari, it was called, and it was we used to have I can't remember when we used to have a couple of bottles a week. I can't quite remember, because the NCOs used to have the spirits rations, and but we also used to have a cigarette ration, and there used to be kind of these round tins, and they used to hold about 50 cigarettes, and they're like things like Players, Craven A's, or names like that. But you see, I didn't smoke, and I used to use my cigarettes, and when I used to give them to the Koreans, and we, you know, the Korean laborers, and they used to kind of do the washing, and we used to give them a handful of cigarettes and things like that, and I suppose they could then, if they need be, they could always barter and that. But there were lots and lots of cigarettes about anyway, especially from the Americans, because in those days, which was a new thing for the British troops, you used to get, the Americans always got their cigarettes in these 200 packs, you know, these Camels and all these other different American names and things like that.
But you didn't start smoking while you were there, because a lot of people did start smoking.
No, I perhaps had an odd puff. I mean, there were cigars about and things like that, mostly come from the Americans, but I perhaps had an odd puff, but I just didn't smoke, full stop.
And any reason why not? I mean, a lot of people don't smoke now. I don't smoke, but it was more common to smoke in your time, and I just wondered, was there any reason, did you just not like it?
No, I suppose the only time I really had the odd puff sort of thing was at school. And we used to have like the odd, used to buy these packets of five Woodbines out of these machines for about six old pence in those days. And that, and so I just did not smoke. I didn't particularly like it as such.
Harassing fire, the mortars harassing fire at night. Now, would you be involved, or were you just aware of it happening? Because this isn't using the command post, is it? This is just firing over there.
Where we was actually based, actually on the mortars, because there was different troops of mortars dotted all along the actual line, and they're attached to the different infantry battalions. And so when in the night time, this is when all most of the activity used to start. This is when all the patrols used to go out, either the Chinese patrols or the British or the United Nations patrols and that. And so there used to be all these different parts, you know, because it was all hills and valleys where kind of like these patrolling actions would be. And in front of the British line, when it began to settle down, it became a massive barbed wire and especially minefields and things like that. So there used to be these slots where these used to go through. And so so what they used to be, what they called harassing fire. Now, these patrols, or where kind of any action would actually start up these points. So what we used to do on the mortars, we used to kind of pre-target these mortars on a different position where these patrols actions would actually start, or where we thought the Chinese would come. And then every so often, when the people were actually on guard at night sort of thing, they just used to, not at any set time, it would be any time, maybe half an hour, quarter of an hour, things like that. So it's not a regular pattern, so the enemy would know kind of a regular pattern when to avoid it. So they just used to slide one of these bombs down there, and you just go off with a bang sort of thing, and then you'd hear another bang maybe half an hour later. That. But you see, with the 25-pounders behind, the field guns, they had a greater range than the mortars. The mortars could only theoretically just lop it over the top of the hills. But with the 25-pounders, they got this greater range. So they was quite often, there was constantly, the harassing fire was on the go all the time. And the same with the tanks. They used to do some of this harassing fire as well.
You also support at night patrols. Can you talk a bit about that? You mentioned this before about a patrol of the Canadians, but I just wondered, I mean, what would happen when you were called? Would you be ready and waiting to support a patrol that you knew was out? Or?
Well, during the daytime, we was on call all the time. The gunners, they never slept in the day. You're not allowed to sleep in the daytime. So all we was doing in the daytime, we was either firing targets, we were digging holes, or we was doing all things physical and things like that. Now, when it came to nighttime, there'd be the people who would be on duty in the command post on what we call stags, seem to say, like the on the guard duties, you know, and then kind of say the guard duties themselves, as it got colder and colder, more bitter, they had to make the period time much smaller because of the bitter cold and things like that. So instead of where perhaps in England you do 2 hours on, 4 hours off, 2 hours on, things like that, it would be just for an hour on or periods like that. But sorry, I've lost my chain of thought.
Yeah, we're talking about when you fired in support of patrols. I mean, how it was arranged, how it was sorted. Because these are British or Australian, yeah, or Canadian.
Sometimes when it actually came patrols, the information would come back from the infantry and to our OPs, which were just on top of the hill sort of thing and things like that. And they would have the information, and we would perhaps get the information. So when some of these patrols went out, the patrols always took a radio with them. So they was able to kind of to radio back. And if they wanted support as such, we would then have a take post anytime through the night period and things like that. And so we would be firing on support of them. Now, I do remember one thing which was perhaps a little bit humorous, but perhaps a bit more serious. I think one of our artillery officers, he went out as a gunner kind of a supporter with them to give them, you know, to artillery fire if they came any problems. And of course, I think this was one of the big patrols going out, and I think they got ambushed as such. And so that he was I think he was the captain of the A troop as such. He was a stickler for wireless procedure when he was actually in Hong Kong, when we was actually training to go to Korea and things like that. Anyway, they got ambushed. And of course,
which regiment was this? Do you know?
I'm not quite sure which regiment it was, sort of thing, because we was dotted all along the line.
I understand that.
And so kind of like this message kind of came through asking for this supporting fire, and of course you imagine kind of people were staggering out of their sleeping bags, half asleep and things like that. And so it was a long time. It was serious for him because he was being attacked at that time. But by the time we actually got mobile, and of course he got quite upset really, kind of because our fire was a long time coming to help him out. And of course it came over this radio, as I remember, he said, "For fuck's sake, fire," and things like that. Because in Hong Kong, he was a stickler for this wireless procedure and things like that. And of course, I mean, it was serious and that. And I remember actually in the command post, I mean, there was a command post officer and two or three signalers and the tower and things like that. And when this, because you could hear everything coming over on the radio, and of course there was this big roar of laughter when it went up, when it kind of like it, because the gunner wireless procedure, it was marvellous really, kind of when they could kind of from the OPs to the guns and things like that and ranging, and it was marvellous.
Now, so that was sort of fire and support. Another thing that's just, I'm going through your memoirs, obviously picking up points for a bit more detail about. What about the propaganda leaflets that you found? What were they like, and did they have any impact on you at all?
Well, so sometimes what used to happen, because there was a lot of propaganda leaflets was dropped. The Americans dropped lots and lots of them, you know, by planes and things like that. And I don't know how the Chinese did theirs, but a lot of theirs used to kind of, sometimes you could perhaps go out in the morning sort of thing, and kind of with the wind blowing and that. And I suppose the infantry got more of these propaganda leaflets than we did. But I remember going out to pick him one up sort of thing, and I've actually still got it in my memoirs as such. And it was one of those things which I can't actually remember the real wordings, but it was more or less kind of they're offering you to kind of come over to their side sort of thing, and they would look after you and they'd attend to your wounds and they would all things like that. But you see, there were quite a few of these Chinese propaganda leaflets, and people had kept them as more or less souvenirs as such. But I mean, I can't ever remember anyone actually going over to that side and things like that.
Now, as the winter, you said the winter got worse. It peaked for you in January, February, I think, from what you're saying.
No, what actually happened was we went into the line like nearly all these mortar troops, and we actually stopped there. We just kind of moved either to the left or to the right, and we actually, where the infantry battalions, they just kept chopping and changing, which is understandable. I mean, they was in front of us, and they was actually going out on patrols all the time, and people were getting killed all the time. But when it came to, we actually moved back. It was only a matter of just over the, just a few, so many hundred yards sort of thing to the rear of our normal position, and it was to give us a bit of a break, as I remember, that we was allowed to go to sleep at night time, and we did not fire any rounds at night time, but we was firing during the daytime. The only time we'd actually fire at night time is if the kind of the forward position was being attacked, and we'd have to come in operation there. And then after about a couple of weeks, we just went back to our own positions and things like that, which was only, what shall I say, it was only a matter of so many hundred yards in front. But when it came to, I think it was February, we'd been in the line now since, I think it was about November, so many months and that, and of course we was all tired and what have you. And I think there was this great big fear that kind of coming up to the to the previous years when the big the spring battle started, like at the Imjin and what have you, and they quite expected the Chinese would once again, when the weather began to start improving, that they would be this big surge coming from the Chinese again. So what they did, they did different units in at different intervals. They would go back so far back sort of thing, and they would try to dig a new position so that if when the Chinese did attack in this expected spring offensive, we would then kind of fall back to these new positions, and then we could continue kind of firing and things like that. But it was about a February period, and the winter had more or less practically come into one of its bitterest and things like that. And we went back to somewhere down near the Imjim, I think it's where the Gloucesters had been, somewhere around that part around there. And so we got to start digging all these kind of pits and things for the mortars and things like that. And of course the ground, it was frozen so hard, and of course after all these breaking all these pick handles trying to chip this hard soil away sort of thing, they just more or less gave up. And of course at that time, as well as I remember, that these so-called muddy old tarpaulins, which had been on top of our bunkers with all the rain and that had been frozen and things like that, we got there, they turned out to be our so-called tents. And of course we got there with practically no tent pegs or anything like that, and the ground was so hard and you couldn't bash these tent pegs or what little we'd got in, and so we had to try and tie it to any kind of foliage and things like that. And I remember it then started snowing, and it started snowing quite a lot, and by the time we'd actually put this tent up sort of thing, we put it actually up on top of snow. And so when we'd actually got it up, I remember scooping away all this kind of this snow and things like that, and I put down my kind of ground sheet and my sleeping bag and things like that. And I remember that night there that I, because it was so bitterly cold, and we got no heating at all in these tents at that time. And so I remember kind of putting, like say, my sleeping bag down. And when it came to night time, because I mean, we was behind the lines, you know, for this couple of weeks or whatever it was. And so there was no firing as such. So I remember taking off my boots and things like that, and I'm not sure whether I took my big parka off, I suppose I'd have to really, and I remember squeezing into that double sleeping bag with all the rest of the clothes on, and I remember my feet were so cold, and I remember kind of trying to rubbing them and that, and then eventually kind of as the sleeping bag warmed up, your feet got to more or less to the bottom of the sleeping bag. But as the morning kind of progressed sort of thing, you know, kind of your feet was right up again and your feet were frozen again and that. And so it went on, but then we then tried to make some sort of a fire sort of thing, you know, to put inside the tents. And these were these kind of these round oil drums and things like that. I'm not sure, we started off with firewood and things like that. And although it was kind of quite dangerous to have these kind of fires in a tent, I mean, it did help a bit. But you see, after about 2 weeks, and no positions were actually completed because kind of the ground was so solid and things like that, we just went back to our old mortar position, and these other people pulled out again. And
before we come down, can I just ask you what exactly you wore? Because you've touched on some of this, but in a way, you've got no clothes on. Tell me what you wore building up in layers. Because it was, as you mentioned about your own, we've already done the underwear in a sense. Yeah. But what would, at this worst part, what would you be wearing to keep the cold?
Well, when we actually was leaving Hong Kong, we had the jungle green battle dress, the shorts and the trousers and the bush hats and what have you. Before we were left, they then issued us back with the old army khaki battle dress, which they used to wear in England, I suppose in Germany and places like that. And then eventually they started giving us our winter clothing. And then, as I remember, our winter clothing, it's more or less starting from nothing. We had these pair of these kind of these pants sort of thing, which had a slit front and back. I'm talking about the winter period, or even the long drums, which went more or less went right down to the, I suppose, the ankles. And then on the first thing to the body was a string vest. Now, the first time I'd ever seen these string vests, or so that went to the skin. And then we had the ordinary singlet vest, which was issued in England, like a PT vest and that. Then we had the ordinary khaki shirt, as I remember, and then we had the ordinary, what we call the ordinary thin pullover, which was issued in England. And then we had a lovely big thick khaki one with tabs on it. It used to have a string around the neck sort of thing. It was a beautiful pullover, that. Then over the top of that, we had what we call equivalent of what the English anorak is now, with a hood. And then over the top of Oh, and then over the top of the trousers, because we had windproof trousers, which was kind of like a nylon, I suppose, in those days, and things like that was so supposedly windproof. Then over the top, we had these khaki trousers with a string round the waist sort of thing, which you mostly see like the paras wear and things like that in there. And then over the whole top of the small anorak sort of thing, we had this big parka, which was a big thing, and it had this big hood on, and it had a wire around the strip, and you could actually bend that wire more or less to a slip, and then kind of the parka itself, it had like a shirt tail, and so you could actually pull that in between your legs, and there used to be two big buttons at the front, and you could put at the top there. Now, when it came to footwear, they took off they took off the old army, the army leather boots sort of thing, the old ammunition boots, I think they used to call them. We used to have studs in and things like that, and we was issued with some like a larger size. It looked the same, but it was like a more of a rubbery material and things like that. And underneath, the sole was actually screwed on, if I remember rightly, and it was like seem to say like the bottoms of Wellington boots, but these were oversized, and inside the actual boot itself, these were kind of like some gauze socks, and they used to put those in there. And then I think the theory was that kind of like if in the event of any activity like digging and all things like that, if your body started sweating or your feet sweated, that any form of sweat would filter through this gauze socks to the bottom, and it would stop your feet freezing to the bottom of the boot. And then on top of that, we had the ordinary thick army socks, as I remember, and then I had a big thick pair over the top of those. And that is, and of course, with the sleeping, we had two.
You still have putties as well.
Oh yeah, because normally at that period, we're talking about the 1950s. The soldier used to have what they call gaiters. These were kind of like a thing around your ankles, but they issued us with putties when we went to Hong Kong, because we used to wear shorts there. So we took these putties with us. And so with these putties, it's like the minor version, I suppose, of the old World War One, where they used to come right up the legs, but ours are just over the ankles. So we used to kind of wrap it round the top of the boot and the bottom of the actual the trouser, and it used to keep the wind out. Now, these gaiters, as I remember, kind of in England, they're all right for kind of when you're on show as such, you know, with all this smart thing like that, but you see, once you're in these activities where you're bending and twisting and lifting and things like that, the trousers would come out of the gaiters, but with the putties it kept them solid, and it keep the cold out as well.
What about your
but the headdress? Now, the what I remember there, they actually issued us with some gloves. These are like these ski type gloves. These were kind of like, if I think they were white and that, and I'm not sure whether they had two compartments, I suppose, one for the thumb and one for the rest of the fingers, and they were joined together with a tape around your actually neck. But they were just hopeless for people, say like myself, who've got a plotting targets or what have you. And then for the headdress that I remember we took from Hong Kong, we took the bush hat, because quite a lot of people actually in Hong Kong in the warmer periods and things like that still wore the bush hats, especially some of the Scottish regiments and things like that. But we mostly either wore that or we had the blueberry, and this was basically our headdress.
What did you get parcels with sort of woolens and things from home?
Yes, there was one period, I think it was around about the Christmas period, as I remember, that I think there was these campaigns back home in England, you know, asking to send, I suppose, similar to like World War II sort of thing, asking these elderly ladies and that to, if they could knit some mufflers and balaclavas and gloves and these mitten type things and things like that. And so what actually happened to our little group of about 30 odd gunners, we had a parcel come from Wallasey in Cheshire, and it was all these woolens and that and balaclavas. And so I was very fortunate really that I got out of this parcels. I got this beautiful balaclava sort of thing, which I used to use all the time. And also that I got some mittens, because although they were woolen gloves and things like that, as a tarer, I had to kind of pluck the tar, kind of using kind of the protractors and the pencils and all things like that. So I was very fortunate, really. This was a godsend to me, really, this balaclava and these mittens. But at the same time, when this parcel of woolens came, I remember there was a letter in there asking it to be acknowledged. And our officer, he actually wrote back to this, I think it's like a Women's Institute type thing. He actually wrote back to him and thanking them and blah, blah, blah. And he mentioned about one of our signalers. Now, this lad, he'd been an orphan. He'd been in one of these homes in Scotland and things like that. And so when these orphans come to about the age of, I think, about 16, they're kind of like Bernardos, and I think they're kind of, in those days, I think they're encouraged to go into the army, where they kind of, they got a home, they got food, and they got clothing and what have you. And so when it actually came to any form of mail from back home in England sort of thing, we used to take about, I suppose, about 6 weeks to get there by boat. And of course he never had any mail or anything like that. And so this officer actually asked if anyone could kind of do a pen friend and that. So I think what actually happened, they put it in the local Wallasey newspaper, and it went through, and he was inundated with all these letters and things like that. And I remember kind of like, say, because I was with him in the command post and knew him very well sort of thing, I used to help him kind of do this. He was actually in the same dugout as I was, and I used to help him, you know, kind of reply to some of these people back home in Wallasey and that. And there was an after thing after that, you know, kind of what actually happened.
Now, what about your own letters and parcels from your own family? I mean, did you write home? Did you get letters? Was it important?
Well, back home, because like I say, I come from a family of brothers and sisters and things like that. And I suppose like most of those families in those days, it was usually the mother used to write the letters. And so these letters used to kind of come, and I think it was a British Army Post Office No. 3, as I remember it. And but they used to come by sea, and some of these ships, they used to take anything up to about 6 weeks, you know, to get there, and then they had to kind of come up zigzag up through the front line and things like that. And so used to kind of have this mail. But one thing I do remember was Christmas time, that my mother, she had actually made one of these Christmas, because I think they were still rationing in England, but she made this Christmas cake made of all, you know, currants and sultanas and bits and pieces and things like that. And she'd packed it up in this parcel and all things like that. And of course, the problem really was it took about 6 weeks to get there. And when this actually parcel came, I remember being in the command post, and the officer there, who was a lieutenant sort of thing, he was one of the Sandhurst type officers, very good he was. Anyway, he said, when he opened it, said, oh, he says, a Christmas cake. He says, let's have a piece. So started cutting up to kind of share it, you know, between the signalers and the bits and pieces in there. And of course, having been in the hold of these ships and things like that, in his first thing, oh, he said, it's mouldy. And I always remember, of course, I was quite disappointed, really. And I do actually remember eating quite a bit of this cake, because I thought, it's come all this way, I will attempt to eat some of it. But I never did tell my mother and things like that later on.
And what were the letters important? I presume they were, that you got from your mum.
Well, it was important, but also as well, she used to send these, the local newspaper used to do the Kettering Evening Telegraph, but at weekends they used to do a weekly one, which covered tidbits out of each day and things like that. And also in those days, they used to do a football newspaper called the Pinken, and I think Kettering was a pink one and Northampton was a green one. So she used to send the pink one, and every so often these things used to come rolled up with just a piece of brown paper around, because it was cheaper in those days and things like that. And like I say, I used to, you know, enjoy reading that. And I remember kind of reading this Kettering Pinken football, because I used to play a lot of football before I joined the army. And this person, he put his head over the top of me, and he says, he said, are you from Kettering? And of course he turned out from Northampton and things like that, and he was one of the signals, because quite often when you used to get these replacement people used to come, because he was a replacement, and you didn't really know, because you didn't really know where they came from and that. And so that was a big bonus for them.
Did you write home yourself? What would you write home to your mum? Would you let her know what was really happening, or would you sort of...
I did write home, but you see, we was in these awful conditions. It isn't as though you got something solid, you could actually put a piece of paper on where you could, you know, like a table or a bench or something like that. You more or less actually wrote it actually I think it was like on a magazine on your knee or word to that effect and things like that. And of course also as well, where you was actually firing and you was digging, and it was 24 hours a day it was, and then at night time you was firing. And quite often, because a lot of them had girlfriends in those days, and those people actually used to write to girlfriends, but I never had a girlfriend in those days and that, and so I didn't, just used to write home to my parents. And so I used to write home at the period when there was a slot, or kind of not too frequently. And I remember there was one period when I didn't write home for about 6 weeks, and they became quite concerned, you know, because sometimes in the paper there were some of these big battles being recorded. I didn't record a lot. They were a bit concerned what was actually happening there. But I didn't really write home any nasty things. I used to kind of find that I was shelling last night and all bits and pieces and things like that, and I was going on leave or going to Tokyo and bits and pieces like that.
Would you let her know how bad the conditions, how the cold was and things like that?
No, not really, because it was a job really to explain, because in those days, in coming up to 1950, I mean, Britain had some nasty kind of winters like 1947, where they had lots of snow sort of thing. And so really the actual troops as such, they'd actually come from the war period, and so all they'd been used to really was perhaps having just a coal fire in like the little tiny living room, and when they used to go to bed at night time it used to be like an ice box. And so, and lots of them had been actually in the forces, so they were really quite hardy, and so they wouldn't feel it so much as they would perhaps now in the 2006.
So they wouldn't make such a fuss writing home.
No.